Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 189 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Thanks to Christine Sneed and Mark Kaplan for pitching in. Our guest this week is bassist Dennis Dunaway, one of the key figures in the 70s rock band Alice Cooper. That's right, the band Alice Cooper, as opposed to the singer Alice Cooper, who continued on with a successful solo career after the band broke up in 1974. Now the surviving members of the Alice Cooper band have reunited to record their first album since 1973's Muscle of Love. This one is called The Revenge of Alice Cooper, and it comes out July 25th. Dunaway, as usual, plays bass, writes, and provides backing vocals. The original Alice Cooper band formed in Phoenix, Arizona in the late 60s after stints as the Spiders and the Nazz. When they had to change the latter name because Todd Rundgren's band already had it, they went with Alice Cooper. They liked the contrast between what sounded like a sweet old lady name and their demonic brand of rock. The singer, Vince Fernier, wound up changing his name to Alice Cooper as well, which turned out to be a savvy branding move. How did Dunaway and his bandmates feel about that? With the band now living in Los Angeles, Frank Zappa's Straight label released its psychedelically freaky first two albums, 1969's Pretties for You and 1970's Easy Action. They did just okay. The group also was developing a reputation for shocking stunts on stage, including, at one early Toronto concert, a live chicken being thrown into the audience and torn apart. In 1970, the group relocated to the Detroit area, the home of such theatrical hard-driving bands as the Stooges, the MC5, and Parliament Funkadelic. The Alice Cooper band convened with young producer Bob Ezrin to record a single intended to show Warner Brothers that it was commercial enough to deserve a whole album. The song, co-written by the five bandmates, was the anthem, I'm 18. They got their album. Love It to Death, which features Dunaway's nine-minute epic, Black Juju, kicked off a winning streak of albums that included Killer, School's Out, Billion Dollar Babies, and Muscle of Love. All but the last of those was produced by Ezrin. During this time, the live presentations grew even more elaborate. Dunaway, who was married to the band's original costume designer, Cindy Smith Dunaway, was a driving force behind the theatrics. No wonder his 2015 memoir was titled Snakes, Guillotines, Electric Chairs, My Adventures in the Alice Cooper Group. Alice Cooper, the person, offered this blurb. Dennis is one of the few true surrealists that I've ever met. Dunaway here explains what the singer meant. More than 50 years after the Alice Cooper band broke up, it's back with its eighth studio album, also with Ezrin at the controls. The Revenge of Alice Cooper features original members Cooper, Dunaway, guitarist Michael Bruce, drummer Neil Smith, and even a previously unreleased recording featuring lead guitarist Glenn Buxton, who died in 1997. Dunaway has played on some of Cooper's solo albums, and the band is regrouped on occasion, including for its 2011 induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What was the dynamic like finally to write and record again as a group? Did old tensions resurface? What's the deal with the band touring or not touring to support this album? Who's Mr. Nice Guy now? Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Dennis Dunaway. Yeah, you guys were in Phoenix, you were in LA, and then you were in the Detroit area, which feels like it's your home base.
Oh my God, they all do. It's pretty amazing. We have so many friends from all of those different places. I've been here the longest. So, you know, I've lived in this house for 50 years now. So this is home. Wow. But all of those are home. We, you know, our LA friends, our Arizona friends, and Detroit friends, all, we talk to all of them fairly regularly.
So, and it's been, what, like over 50 years since the last official Alice Cooper band album, right? Yeah. And now you've got The Revenge of Alice Cooper. Yeah. Like, what's it like getting the band back together after 50 years?
Well, it's hard to believe. I mean, who'd have ever thunk? A couple of times over the decades, there were rumors blew up about us doing an album, and we thought it was going to happen, and Alice would be excited, and then it wouldn't happen. So it was another one of those things where we weren't popping any champagne until we saw it actually happen. And there's been a lot of steps leading up to this. Like, of course, when we were inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2011, we all got together and performed for that. We've done Alice's Christmas pudding benefits for the Solid Rock Teen Center in Phoenix, Arizona, a few different years. 2019 was the last time we did one. But so that required getting together and rehearsing a bit and then playing on stage together. And then we've recorded on Alice's The Paranormal album, the Detroit Stories album. And so there have been steps leading up to this. But I think the last straw, well, it didn't break the camel's back, but the final thing that made it happen is Neil is a snowbird. He lives in Connecticut, but he goes out to Arizona for the winters. And when he's out there, he will go over to Michael Bruce's studio and they'll kick around song ideas and jam and everything. And then whenever Alice is home, which is kind of rare, but Alice would go over there and kick around some songs. And then they got excited about some of the tunes that they had been coming up with. And I got a call from Bob Ezrin, and Alice said, "Hey, let's do an album."
Right. So the process for this, I mean, you guys had this classic run of albums, obviously, from Love It to Death to through Muscle, and like, what was the creative process like for this when you're sort of, again, picking up after 50 years?
Well, one of the steps, first of all, we started out, Neil had like 30 songs and I had like 30 songs at least, and Michael had a ton of songs. So we were thinking that we had 5 albums worth of material. How are we going to narrow that down to 10 songs, even though it ended up being 13 songs and a cover song on top of that? So we decided, Bob Ezrin, I believe, was behind this, but we got together in Phoenix, Arizona at the Solid Rock Teen Center. They have studios and dance studios and recording studios and everything going on there. And so it was just Michael, Alice, Neil, and I. So the idea was we would get together without Bob Ezrin and just see if we could, get the cobwebs out of the works and, and get it back together. Well, there was no getting it back together. We walked in the studio and it's the same as it always has been. Us joking around, everybody knows exactly what needs to be done to make a song good, and we're all experimenting. Everybody's throwing out ideas. Nobody has the final say. And we came up with Black Mamba on that occasion, with Wild Ones, the Intergalactic Vagabond Blues, and maybe some other songs. So we just knocked those out in a couple days.
So you came in with all these songs, but then you were still coming up with new stuff together.
Right. Black Mamba was actually, we were in the studio and we were going to warm up, and Neil said, "Hey, Michael, what's that riff that you were jamming on the other day?" And Michael started playing it, and then I came up with the bass line, and Alice came up with the melody. In fact, it was so brand new from the ground up that at one point we took a little break to go in the studio to listen to the drum sound. And Alice, we went back out there, and Alice had totally forgotten the melody that he had come up with. And luckily, I remembered it. So we got back on track there. But, it was very spontaneous and a lot of fun because we
You
just.
got the snake thing going on again too with Black Mamba, and also it's kind of a callback to Black Juju.
Right. Yeah. Both of those things. Alice decided, okay, well, let's make one about the most dangerous snake in the world, a black mamba. And so right off the bat, we said, okay, well, because this groove that Michael's playing has such a kind of a voodooish kind of a feel to it, let's go that route. Let's think like New Orleans.
So, when you guys were recording your earlier albums, there was obviously this element of theatricality to you know, how you were presenting them on the record and then especially live. Did you have that in mind when you were making this album as well?
I think that's just how we think. I mean, even all the way back to Pretty's for You, those records were as avant-garde, abstract as possible, but we still had theatrical concepts in mind. The band started because Alice and I were in art class in high school, and we loved Salvador Dali and the New York City pop scene and happenings and all of that, and we decided we were going to start a band and incorporate artistic ideas into it. So I think that's why this band always gets such a live feel, even when we're rehearsing, because we just think like that. We imagine that we're in front of, you know, the Hollywood Bowl audience and we're entertaining them rather than just, okay, let's write a song and then later on we'll see if we have any theatrical ideas for it. We just automatically go into that. It's our nature.
Yeah, he has Alice has a blurb on your book, Snakes, Guillotines, Electric Chairs, where it says, Dennis is one of the few true surrealists that I've ever met. Like, how would you describe your surrealism?
Well, I don't know. I'm the guy, Alice nicknamed me Dr. Dreary because we would be driving around the whole band in a station wagon with the electric chair tied to the top of this vehicle and then a van with the equipment in it, and in the car would be the fiery blazing cutting humor of Glenn Buxton, and everybody knows Alice is clever, Neil's very clever with his humor, he gets very goofy, and Michael's got kind of offbeat humor, but I would be the quiet one in the back of the station wagon, kind of just being quiet, listening to all the different things going back and forth. And then I would come up with a joke, and everything would come to a screeching halt while everybody wondered, what did I mean by that? So I've always crusaded for being different. I've always crusaded for songs with minor chords and with a key change in the middle, so you can hear that on this album. But each guy has their own thing that's like that, and all the rest of us kind of know what the other guy's going to do at almost any given moment, especially Neil and I. We don't even have to look at each other, though we do, because when we're just exploring, improvising, I can tell when he's going to do something and vice versa. It's almost like this intuitiveness from working together for so many years.
Right. And in terms of the band's presentation and sort of the surrealism in that, like, was that your category for a lot of it?
I was the crusader, and, you know, I was quiet in real life. I was an introvert. All I did is think about what's the next thing that we can do. But when we were in the rehearsal room, I was the loud guy stirring everything up all the time. And early on, I think the band kind of got used to giving in to something I was crusading for, rather than, you know, sweat it out until they had to give in the end anyway. And Alice also thinks in those terms. So if I would come up with something pretty abstract, then a lot of them would miss. You know, I just blurt out ideas and then some of them stick. But when I can tell that one's a good idea, then I go on my soapbox and promote it. And the band has always been really good that way as far as collaborating. We will try everybody, if anybody that has an idea, we have to give it a heartfelt try and play it. And then we vote. And then we just move forward with whatever the majority wants to do, and no grudges or anything. And it can get quite loud because we're passionate about what we think is the best idea for each part of the song. And people that don't know us well, because we grew up in high school, with put down humor, you know, and it gets loud and we're all raving about what we think is the best, and people wouldn't go near the rehearsal room. They say, wow, you guys really hate each other, don't you? No, what are you talking about? No, it never got personal. It was just always like, if somebody walked out of a room that the band was in, we knew that we were getting whittled down the whole time until we got back. And then if anybody else left, it was their turn for us to make fun of them. So, and that to this day, that was very present in the studio, even though Glenn isn't with us anymore. He passed away in 97. But the spirit of Glenn is on this album big time.
Right. And with some old recordings of him as well, at least one.
Yeah. It's a tape that I had, a cassette tape that I kept in a good place so that it didn't deteriorate over the decades. It was Glenn had this riff that he was jamming on, and him and I went to the rehearsal room at the Gillespie Estate where the band lived in Greenwich, Connecticut in 1973. And it's just him and I going over this riff for about an hour, over and over, trying to come up with some ideas to turn it into a song. And then when the band came in the next day for rehearsal, we started out with that riff, but then it started morphing radically into another song. It was Never Been Sold Before. And then the song took on a different nature where the riff didn't fit the song anymore. So then I always wanted to finish this song. So I told Bob Ezrin I had this tape, and he said, oh yeah. You know, I said, with today's technology, you can clean it up, right? Yeah, yeah. So that's the other song that we wrote from the ground up spontaneously right in the studio. We had the riff in our headphones, and we got a click beat, a click track to it for the tempo. And then we wrote a song to go with that riff. And we use Glenn playing the riff on the song, and he gets a writer's credit and everything.
The Alice had worked with Bob Ezrin after the band had broken up, but was there any, you know, water that had to go under the bridge to get all of you together again with Bob Ezrin, who I think the last one of the band he produced was, what, Billion Dollar Babies, right?
Billion Dollar Babies was the last time we worked with him, even though we had worked with him on Alice's solo albums.
Right.
Each of us, you know, I did a song, Michael did one, and Neil did a song. So that was with Bob. And Bob was definitely the catalyst for getting this back together, because he's like another member of the band. So he comes in, shows up with this enthusiasm, almost like a cheerleader or something, you know. He walks into the studio, all right, let's make an album, you know. Reminds me of the Mickey Rooney and those movies, the Hardy movies, you know.
Right.
Says, oh, Larry needs an operation. Let's put on a show. and then also Bob has the knowledge of when there's a difference of opinion as to what should happen on a particular part of a song. He lets us debate it, but if it starts to look like it's bogging down and going to cost us studio time and maybe interrupt getting to the deadline, then he'll come in and say, okay, nope, we're good. That's a good idea, but we're going to do this one. And we're all fine with that. That's what a producer does. But the main thing is Bob lets us do our thing. And then he just guides it. The other thing about Bob is he's been there. You know, he knows everything that's happened with the band. So and there's definitely no bad blood between any of us. You know, we were all together for so many years, worked together and constantly, that it's like a family. You know, family has their hurdles here and there, but But we've all maintained our friendships over the years.
Were there any hurdles that you had to overcome to kind of get this project going again? You know, anything that needed to be resolved from long ago?
No, the only thing is it just took a phone call. You know, Neil's been ready. I've been ready for forever. You know, I never wanted to break the band to break up in the first place. And actually, nobody wanted the band to break up. Alice said he wanted to go into acting, and then Michael wanted to do a solo album. And then we said, okay, well, then Michael record his solo album. We'll take some time off so that Alice and Glenn can kind of get control of their drinking because it had become a pretty big problem. And then we will come back together and we'll make the next Alice Cooper album. It'll be bigger and better than ever. And then Welcome to My Nightmare landed a record deal, which the band should have had, you know, because most bands don't start making real money until they sign their second recording contract and they have enough clout to get it going.
Right.
So, you know, all of those things went down, but let's face it, we were young and we were also musicians. So musicians don't, their maturity level doesn't always match their age.
You guys had named the band Alice Cooper, and then Vince had taken the name Alice Cooper, and then was able to keep putting out albums by Alice Cooper, but it wasn't the band anymore. Was there sort of a feeling of you guys like, oh man, how did that happen? You know, like people are going to think we're on this and we're not even, you know, getting anything from this, or and we're not even part of it anymore.
Well, in the early days, when we were Alice Cooper and we were doing Pretties for You, the avant-garde stuff, it was so art. We were like bohemian artistic people, you know. And if somebody walked into a room where the band was and said, "Hey, Alice," nobody would look. Vince wasn't Alice. The band was Alice Cooper.
Right.
And so we just looked at, chalked it off as that person doesn't get it. They're not hip. And then, of course, naturally, because of the lead singer. And the lead singer having free hands to do all of our theatrical ideas, then it sort of became a two-headed snake at one point. And then right when we made it to number one, you know, number one album in England and America, biggest tour in 1973 over the Stones and Zeppelin, then all of a sudden, we decided to take a break, which was totally against my my better judgment. But you know, that was a long time ago, and it's not like we didn't achieve our goal. We were just a bunch of high school kids that said, "Hey, let's bring theatrics to rock and roll, and let's claw our way to the tippy top of the glittery rock pile," and that's what we did.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you guys have been, you know, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a band. Is there still like, you know, 2025? Is there some like effort needed to say, "Hey, we're the Alice Cooper band, and we need to remind you all that this is a band. You know, this isn't a person. This is like us," and sort of reestablishing your identity again 50 years after the fact. Like 50 years after the last, you know, Alice Cooper band album.
Well, definitely. That's what this album represents to me. It's us reclaiming our legacy with a lot of people. Because a lot of Alice Cooper fans didn't even start listening to Alice Cooper until the solo years. And as in their mind, we were just another one of Alice's backup groups. So, you know, but nevertheless, Alice is still doing the show that we developed, the snake. If you take away what the band did, you'd take away the snake, the makeup, the theatrics, the executions, and a lot of the hit songs. So So, you know, to this day, Alice is still doing our show. And he's got a great touring band. They're all really great. And I'm not sure that I would want to be out there 200 shows a year anymore. You know, being on the road, you know, it's very much like Spinal Tap. You know, it's really fun for the first couple of weeks, and then next thing you know, everybody has cold sores and stuff. Or, you know, when
Setting off metal detectors.
I used to say, so there's three stages. The first stage is touring is exciting, you know, and you're having fun. And you go to town to town, you go, oh, great, I'm back in Chicago or whatever. Well, the big cities are easy, but when you're back in, you know, some other part of Iowa, Clarion, Iowa, or whatever, it starts to become a blur after a while. And the second stage is you wake up and you have to ask somebody what town you're in, you know, or Alice has the sign at the front of the stage saying what town he's in. So he's not saying, hello, Cleveland to
Right.
Chicago, right? And then the third stage is you don't know what town you're in and you don't even care. And you
So
have the Holiday Inn menu memorized.
have you guys looked into doing a tour as the band or what's, you know,
Well,
or shows or promotional things, TV?
you're about the billionth person to ask me that this week, you know, and it's only Wednesday, right? So,
Well, you guys did have a reputation as a live band, so.
hey, our whole thing is live. We brought spectacle to live rock. You know, we're a live band. And the album feels live. I mean, just listen to it. It's got that live energy. So, yeah, you know, I'm ready. I'd love to do shows. All it takes is a phone call. You know, there's never been a problem with, Michael Neal or I, as far as that's not why live shows don't happen. It has to do with we just get a phone call and we're ready.
So
So
Alice needs to call you.
hopefully there'll be shows. I'd love to do some of the songs on this album in particular are very theatrical feeling.
Well, it's interesting because the album's coming out pretty soon, and for you not to know if you guys are doing shows, that seems kind of late in the game, but what do I know?
It does, but with the Alice camp keeps their cards pretty close to their vest, and a lot of times, all of a sudden, this big announcement will be made by Alice, and everybody will be my phone will be ringing off the hook and everything, and then I go, well, I better call Alice to see if this is real. You know, I'm
Have
not always the first one to find out.
you asked him, like, hey, are we doing this? Are we gonna do some live
I
shows
haven't
or
asked him
show up
yet,
on Kimmel or whatever?
but I'm sure everybody in the world that he does an interview with is asking him that. So
Sure.
it's not like it's not in the air. We'll see. And nobody believes me when I say we don't have anything planned because we kept this album a secret for 4 years.
There you go. Yeah, it was just announced like what, like a month and a half ago or something like that, or a couple months
Right.
ago.
And I have 2021, I have emails of Bob saying, okay, let's get moving on this.
If you did do a live show, whether it was a huge tour or just a few dates or whatever, would you want it to be the kind of spectacle you were doing in the 70s?
Yeah, of course. But on the other hand, I don't mind, you know, we were always up against the wall of the Allman Brothers. We don't need theatrics. You know, Alice Cooper uses theatrics for a crutch to hide the fact that they can't play. You know, so like we did this show in Dallas in 2015, which was a book signing for my book, Snakes, Guillotine, Electric Chairs, My Adventures in the Alice Cooper Group. This guy, Chris Penn, had a record store, and we put together a book signing that the Alice Cooper Group did a surprise a show right in the record store on a stage that he had built. And it turned into a movie, and it turned into an album release on Ear Music. So you can see in that film that we all had a lot of fun. And my point is, that was just us playing the songs without any theatrics. And when we just play the songs, people are forced to realize how good the songs are, I think. A lot, the critics can't say, well, they're hiding behind theatrics. It doesn't matter to me. I love the songs and I think they stand on their own, but I am the theatrical guy, so
Right. Well, certainly, I mean, those records have been around for so long, and I got the Rhino High Fidelity did a really nice job with Love It to Death. It sounds fantastic.
love
And
Rhino.
it's, clearly people are listening to those albums without the visuals, it's just the music, and you're kind of like, oh, this really holds up. It really has this crunch and great riffs and melodies and hooks and, power and all that stuff. So it's not like you have anything to prove on that. And it's just sort of interesting because, you're in this different era now. It's like 50 years later, rock isn't considered as mainstream anymore. And
Right. Alice says rock started out as the outlaws, and then we became the more mainstream, genre of music. And then now we're the outlaws again. And I reminded Alice that I married Neil's sister, so we're also the rock and roll in-laws.
well, in I mean, the thing is that, if the Alice Cooper group, toured, it would be like a big deal. Whereas like sort of young guitar bands struggle because they are considered like the outlaws again. Do you hear anyone now doing the kind of music that you were doing, at your peak?
Yeah, they're out there. I mean, Måneskin from Italy, actually Jozzy, who plays on this album. I sat in with him just the last Sunday. Yeah, just a couple of days ago, I sat in with him in Asheville, North Carolina. And their band, I mean, that is definitely throwback. I mean, you hear Zeppelin, you hear Bowie, you hear T-Rex and all of their original music. It's rock. So they're out there. Green Day are still kicking around a strong rock kind of feel and all that.
Sure.
So I think the difference is it's more of a live, well, and the Stones did their album, but it's more of a live feel where musicians are playing their instruments and singing their own songs rather than computers being a major part of the songwriting and lots of people. So it's almost like a corporation writes the songs and produces it and puts it out there and all of that. We're more like down in the trenches, even though Alice's organization is pretty slick and they've got it down. But it's still got that raw edge, which you can hear on the two singles, Black Mamba and Wild Ones. We have the capabilities now over when we did Love It to Death and Killer and those albums to go in and perfect every note, every bass note. Oh, that's a hair behind the bass drum. Let's fix it. Oh, the next one is a hair ahead of the bass drum. Let's fix it. And you suck the life out of a song. We don't do that. We go in and play,
Good.
and that's what you get. And we do use technology to rearrange some of the songs, and then also just to get the best sound possible. So all of a sudden, the bass, if it needs to be bigger on a song, then we can help that. Even though I recorded all of my bass tracks with the same billion-dollar jazz bass, Fender 1970 jazz bass, that I used on those albums back then, on the Killer album and School's Out and Billion Dollar Babies. And I used the same Rotosound strings, and I used the same Herco Ghastly Green pick, and I used the same Ampeg B15 amplifier. So it's exactly the same as what I used on those other albums. Even though I use the amp, most of the tracks are the bass direct, right off the pickups. Just that growl going right into the tape machine. And then on some songs, if we thought it needed a little bit more of a rounder sound or whatever, we'd mix in the bass amp part, which was recorded at exactly the same time. So, you know, it's, but we don't have to try to sound like we used to. We just sound like that. You know, as soon as Neil starts playing and Michael starts playing, it sounds like us. I'm not even sure we could sound like somebody else if we tried.
Right. You know, people listen to music so differently now from, you know, the 70s, where you would have heard the singles on the radio, and maybe you would have heard some album cuts on FM. And otherwise, you'd, you know, sit down and, you know, and put on the record, and you'd like look at the cover and listen to the record and right. stuff. And now, you know, with everything streaming and also these algorithms, like on one hand, you don't have that kind of focus on the album anymore. On the other hand, you know, if someone is into like sort of a modern guitar sort of thing, then the algorithm might pull up, you know, something from Killer or you know, some tracks that you guys did. Do you find that you're being exposed to younger listeners because of the way technology works and how it's actually more accessible, even though it's also just kind of a different way of approaching it?
I think so, because of the vinyl popularity still. You know, we're going to be on the cover of Goldmine magazine and lots of other rock covers around the world, but Goldmine magazine is like the Bible for vinyl collectors, and at one point they thought they were going to go out of business when CDs and everything took over. But now there's still a vinyl trend, and those people are digging back, you know. But that's what we did, you know, back in the British invasion happened, but we were digging back to try to find Muddy Waters records and stuff. So that's happening. And also the biggest fact of having young people know who we are is school's out. Every kid, the last day of school, it's played over their intercom.
Well, and they all turn 18 also.
18, but school's out is the...
That's the one.
...one that's universally known by kids. And, you know, there was a time when I would do these records, autograph signing things, Chiller Theater out of New Jersey, a big monster convention with lots of celebrities. And there would be parents would bring their kid, and you could tell by the look on the kid's face that he had something better to do, you know. And then other times it would be the kid bringing his parents, and they'd look like they, you know, had something more important to do. So it's great. And all these young musicians, they're out there. I mean, a young kid doesn't get a guitar and go to somebody that gives lessons and say, oh, teach me how to play like Taylor Swift. You know, she's a great guitar player, but they say, I want to play like Jimi Hendrix. I want to play like Jeff Beck, you know.
I want to play some killer riff.
Yeah. So that's also still happening. You know, it seems like little girls, a lot of them want to be a ballerina, and boys, you know, they either want to grow up to be a fireman or a rock star.
When you were writing and, you know, recording these songs way back when, like I'm 18 was recorded before the rest of Love It to Death as sort of like a trial, like, can these guys be commercial? That's what I read, at least. When you did I'm 18, did you think, oh, this is a hit? And did you think that the other hits of yours, were those the hits, or were there other songs that you thought were going to be the hits, and it turned out that, nope, school's out, that's the big anthem, you know, I'm 18, that's the big hit?
Well, that's a good point, but let me back up just a little bit. I said little boys want to play guitar. There's a lot of great female killer guitar players.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Including Nita Strauss with Alice. So let me put that in there. But as far as me knowing what a hit is, I've always said, if I knew what a hit was, 90% of what's on the radio wouldn't be there. And on I'm 18, we did go to Warner Brothers and one of their honchos, and we were looking at charts for record sales, and we're going, oh wow, so we're seeing these age groups and stuff, and we're saying, well, what what age is the biggest record buying age? And they said, oh, by far, 18. You're still living at home, but you have a job, so you got money to buy records. And we're going, okay, well, we can relate to that because we were all 18 when we were all going to school in Phoenix, Arizona together. And this was some chord changes that Michael had come up with that wasn't really a song yet. And whenever we would do a sound check, we would warm up by just jamming on these chord changes. And then at one point, we would even do a thing like each of us would go up to the microphone and sing a verse that had popped into our head. And most of them were funny, you know, something with a catchy hook on the joke line. So then we decided, okay, this is getting good now. We're zeroing in on a melody and stuff. And then when we heard this thing about the 18-year-old, we said, okay, we got to do this. And that's when it really kind of zeroed in. And that's the song that Bob Ezrin liked when he heard us first time at Max's Kansas City in New York City. And he thought it was called I'm Edgy. And I even did that. There's a band called The Sick Fucks from the CBGBs in New York City.
Uh-huh.
They're a great band. But I sat in with them one night and we did I'm Edgy and I sent it to Bob Ezrin. But when Bob Ezrin came to the farm in Detroit to help, we needed a hit single. We had a reputation. We'd worked with Frank Zappa. That gained us a lot of validity. We toured with the Mothers of Invention.
Right. His label put out your first three albums.
The first one reluctantly, the second one really reluctantly, and the third one was a court battle. So that's how that went. But we also had the chicken incident up in Canada. So
right.
we had an underground following. But back then, especially, probably still today, promoters were so chart-driven. Even the Mothers of Invention couldn't get the big bucks for it. And they could fill arenas, but they didn't have a song on the radio. So they were limited as to what they could get paid out of a promoter. So we knew that. And we also knew that our artistic songs weren't putting any food on the table. So we decided, okay, we've got to write more relatable songs, and we've got to, if we can get a hit single, then we can do our artistic stuff and people will listen to it because they'll buy the album. So that was our way of thinking. When Bob came to Detroit, he said, okay, first song we're going to work on is I'm Edgy. And we had this long, sprawling organ bluesy intro before the song kicked in. He said, well, let's get rid of that. You know, and we're like, we like that. but then, you know, we wanted a single. So he showed us, he whittled it right down to the amount of time, 3.5 minutes or whatever, and locked it in place. And then we decided, okay, well, we'll play our other version live on stage. So we were happy with that. And I had no idea it was really going to be a hit because, you know, we thought Pretty's for You was going to set the world on fire because Zappa played it for the Beatles before it was released and told us that they loved it. And then Easy Action, you know, we thought, hey, okay, now we finally got it. And wah, wah. So as far as Love It to Death, we walked into the studio thinking, oh my God, no band gets three chances, and this is our third chance. And if we strike out this time, that's the end. So I'm 18, you know, okay, it sounds good. It's all right. That's the one they're going to push. And then CKLW out of Canada, Windsor, Canada, right across the river from Detroit. They had this outrageously powerful transmitter that wouldn't be legal in America, but it covered the whole Midwest and Canada. And this DJ Rosalie Trombley. They called her the girl with the golden ear. Bob Seger even wrote a song about her because she made hits for those Midwestern bands.
Right, and he's up there in Detroit, so he's getting the signal.
That's right, and it got so much play. At one point, it was every fifth song was I'm 18.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but as far as knowing what was a hit before it came, before we heard it on the radio, School's Out was the song. That's the first one that we all said, this is a hit single. We can feel it before we even record it. And same with Elected. I felt that that one was a hit.
Right.
But generally, you know, we let the experts, the record companies and the disc jockeys kind of guide us as to what they thought was a hit.
No More Mr. Nice Guy? Did you think, oh, that's one?
Yeah, that one seemed like pretty much a shoe-in. Yeah.
So did the reception for I'm 18 kind of fuel the sessions then for Love It to Death? Like, did you sort of go into the studio with a different mindset at that point?
Well, don't forget our androgynous image and things we did on stage that upset parents. And a lot of DJs or television stations wouldn't have us on because they were worried their advertisers wouldn't go for it, this crazy band with a singer named Alice, you know? Hey. Even when we had a hit single, it was still, you know, there was tough times. You know, we'd go into rooms where everybody was throwing stuff at us. So it wasn't overnight that we felt successful. In fact, it was such a slow, because of our image, there was a lot of people that would yell insults to us when we walked into the venue and then throw anything they could get their hands on at the stage. But
after paying for a ticket for you guys?
Yeah, but I think a lot of them paid a ticket so they could go and throw stuff at us. And other people paid for a ticket because their girlfriends liked us, which meant that they hated us that much more. So I don't know, but we had some pretty rough nights coming up. And even after a lot of people thought we were successful, it still was hard to feel like that for us because every rock critic would pan our albums. You know, it got to the point where when we got a good review, we were kind of worried that that wasn't going to be good because we seemed to be making a career off of bad reviews. But when we played the Hollywood Bowl, then I finally said, okay, nobody plays a Hollywood Bowl unless they've made it. So we've made it.
At what point was that? Like, where? What album?
School's Out. It just came out.
At what point do you feel like you guys peaked as a band, just in terms of playing together and clicking on all cylinders?
I don't know. This new album feels pretty darn good to me. But let's say, okay, so like I said, there were worries walking into the studio for Love It to Death, even though we felt the material was strong. But then after the hit I'm 18, okay, now we knew people would be listening. So we walked into the studio for Killer, all feeling pretty across the board confident. And we also were doing so many gigs at that point that our playing abilities were quite sharp.
Is that your favorite of your albums?
I might say because of that, even though my heart is with Pretty's for You because of the artistic nature of it.
But and how
Killer,
much?
Yeah, I'll go with Killer. But I keep saying that this sounds like I'm just overhyping, but I love this new album.
Yeah. No, I can't wait to hear the rest of it. But the two singles sound great. So, it sounds cool. And I think it's always amazing, you know, when there's sort of like a gap, you know, and the band comes back and like, oh, are they going to sound like themselves or not? And the fact that you guys sound like yourselves and your last album was in 1973, like that says that's something, you know.
Well, you know, Easy Action did not sound like Produce for You, and Love It to Death did not sound like Easy Action. And those albums we were putting out like a couple a year back then. So of course it's not going to sound like Love It to Death or Killer, but it does in that it, you can tell it's us playing, it's our style of music. And the other thing I think is very much like those albums is it's full of twists and turns, unexpected things. And the original group built our reputation on surprises. People would come to the show, somebody would see a show and tell their friend, hey, you got to see these guys. They electrocute their singer. And then they'd come, and then we wouldn't electrocute the singer. We'd hang him. So we prided ourselves on mixing it up and giving people something new every time around.
In a couple of years, are you guys going to write a song called I'm AT?
Hey, I like that. I like that. Yeah. Okay, we will.
All right, good. Thanks. I don't need any royalties for it, but you know, a special thanks on the record would be good enough. So I appreciate it.
You might have to remind me, but yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, hey, thanks so much for talking. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you, and I can't wait to hear the rest of the record and the stuff you guys are doing. So great talking to you. Thanks so much. That's all for episode 189 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Dennis Dunaway for taking us inside the Alice Cooper Band then and now. The Revenge of Alice Cooper, the first Alice Cooper Band album in 52 years, is out July 25th via Ear Music. Also, the Rhino High Fidelity pressing of Love It to Death, mastered by Carol Pop guest Kevin Gray, came out earlier this year and sounds fantastic. Check out more about Dunaway at DennisDunaway.com. You can buy his memoir, Snakes, Guillotines, Electric Chairs, on the site and elsewhere in various formats, and he reads the audiobook. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Wake, who is Mr. Nice Guy. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you like at CarolPop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCarro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.